guess next.
Yeah, we're leaving Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah, and be gone for the next
two Sundays. Okay. Well, the church shuts down on that second one. They got a special activity going on, so we won't be meeting after Christmas anyway. Yeah, the 29th, the church is going to have a special service with one common service and no Sunday schools. So we couldn't have done that one even if we'd wanted to. All righty. This is the 15th of December. We're studying the post-exilic history of Israel. And remember what's happened here so far. Let me get a little chart out here and try to remind everybody kind of where we are before we march forward. A little easier to read this way. Now, what's happened is after the Babylonian captivity ended, 70 years, they knew it would be 70 years. Daniel knew it because Jeremiah had told them that it would be a 70-year captivity. And so Daniel recognized the timeline, and that's when he started praying for deliverance for the people. Well, the Babylonians were taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire, and the king of the Medo-Persian Empire was kindly disposed toward Israel. He said, hey, all you Jews that have been captive down here for the past 70 years, you can go back home if you want to. And not only that, we'll fund your trip home. We'll raise some money to pay for you to be able to get back from Babylon to Jerusalem, about a 900-mile trip. Take them about 4 months or so. So, and not only was he helpful in that regard, but he said, we'll take up a free will offering to help you rebuild your temple. And I calculated it one time a number of years ago, it was about $90 million in present-day terms, so I'm sure it's more than that now. So they raised a lot of money to rebuild their temple, and the king of Medo-Persian Empire assisted them in coming back home. And about 50,000 of them, 50,000 Jews, went back home from Babylon to Judah, about 50,000. And their job was to get that temple rebuilt. So they got started to do that job under the leadership of two guys, a political leader named Zerubbabel and a religious leader named Jeshua or Joshua. It's spelled differently in different places. I'm just going to call him Joshua. It's a little easier. But the political leader and the religious leader got together and led the exiles, the returned exiles, into rebuilding that temple. And that all started at about 536 BC, right here. And they got off to a decent start. First 2 years or so, they actually did some work. And then they rolled over. Their enemies intimidated them into inaction, and they did nothing. So for about the next 15 years, the exiles are down there doing nothing, becoming couch potatoes. They're not rebuilding the temple, but they should have been. And God then, about 15 years after the start, he says, I got to send me some mouthpieces in there and get these guys jump-started back to work. And so he did. He sent two of his prophets to the returned exiles to get them going again. Remember who they were? Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai was the first prophet that the nation heard from following the exile. And Zechariah was his sort of compadre at that time. And the two of them together then brought a message to those guys, those exiles, those people that had returned. The message was, get off of that sofa and get back to work. And Haggai rebuked them for two particular reasons. One was their prioritization of their own properties over God's house. That wasn't good. God was not happy with them about that. And secondly, they were worshiping God in a distorted, contaminated way. They were using unhealthy animals and things like that. God was not happy to be treated like that by them. But along with those two rebukes, Haggai had some messages of hope and encouragement, and the people got going again. Get after it, people, and they did. So for about 2 years, from 536, they did nothing. For the next 15 years, and then they got back to work. Zechariah comes on the scene just a few months after Haggai, and his message is also contains a little bit of rebuke, but it's mostly a message of encouragement and hope for their future. There's one thing about Israel that you cannot deny. Israel has a future. Not every other country on this planet has a future. Some can be annihilated and completely destroyed, and many will be destroyed. But not Israel. Israel has a future because God has a plan for them that was established with his covenant with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12 that includes not only a line of descent, a territory to live in, and a kingdom, a millennial kingdom, a thousand-year reign of Messiah here on earth. That hasn't happened yet. So that, by definition, means Israel has a future. And most of Zechariah's message is about that future. And we've been seeing a number of them, number of messages from him talking about that future. We're up to chapter 11 in the book of Zechariah, and we're about right here. We've come down about 15 years from their start, maybe 17. And those two guys are prophesying right in through here. Ultimately, they will complete the temple there in 516, 20 years later, due to the restarting of the effort prompted by Haggai and Zechariah. So the post-exilic history of Israel includes three historic books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and three prophetic books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. But we're not taking them in the biblical order, we're taking them in the chronological order. So if you do that, you start in Ezra, you get up to chapter 5, and he refers to the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah, which is where we are. We jumped out of Ezra over to see that ministry, which he talks about in Ezra chapter 5. And then we'll come back to that, Ezra chapter 5, when we complete Zechariah's ministry that we're going through here now. When we get to chapter 11 in Zechariah, we see some stories, some prophecies that have to do with the restoration of Israel into a people, into a land in the Messianic kingdom. But the fulfillment of all of that is going to be delayed because they made the biggest mistake in the history of the Jewish people. They rejected God's Messiah. Not only did he reject him, they killed him. And God judged him because of that. So this delay between, let's say, early 500s B.C., when they could have had some things come together nicely, down to the second advent, which hasn't even occurred yet, what are we talking about here? 2,600 years? So the fulfillment of their blessings that Haggai and Zechariah both talk about will be delayed by about 2,600 years because they rejected their Messiah. Now, we mentioned before, I'll mention it to you again, a lot of these prophecies have dual fulfillments, a near-term fulfillment and a far-field fulfillment. So we're seeing a good bit of that here in Zechariah. Zechariah makes more messianic prophecies than any other book in the Bible other than Isaiah. So if you want to know about Messiah and the Messianic kingdom and aspects of it, of course, study Zechariah. You can study Isaiah if you want to, but you'll celebrate two or three birthdays before you can get through that big thing. But this book has a lot of Messianic prophecies in it. So we're seeing those as we go. So when we get to chapter 11, We get into the story of their rejecting Messiah as their shepherd of the sheep there in Israel. So chapter 11, verse 1, open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. That's destructive, isn't it? The cedars of Lebanon are going to burn. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There's a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lion's roar. The pride of the Jordan is ruined. This is a picture of destruction, of blessings to Israel that will result from their rejection of their Messiah. The riches of the nation will be taken away from them and destroyed by God. So God says to Zechariah, he says, hey, Zechariah, I want you to take on the role of the shepherd of my people. Verse 4, thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. So Zechariah, I want you to kind of pretend to be the Messiah here a little bit, and you shepherd my people for me here. Those who buy them, slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. Jewish leadership that should have been God's shepherds over the nation to take care of them, their kings and their religious leaders and so on, should have been watching out over the nation and taking care of them. That's what national leadership should do. They should shepherd their nation. But they weren't. They didn't. They were shepherding themselves. They were taking care of themselves. They were getting rich off of the people, the nation Israel, and not shepherding them as they should. Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished, and each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them, for I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I shall cause the men to fall, each to another's power and into the power of his king, and they will strike the land, and I shall not deliver them from their power. Israel is going to experience a bunch of national setbacks. National disasters are going to be judged by God for this lack of divine shepherding over the people there. Ezekiel makes a extensive lament over the same situation in the book of Ezekiel. God is very unhappy with the shepherds of Israel in that book as well. Same basic message. So Zechariah responds back, so I pastored the flock doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock, and I took for myself two staffs, the one I called favor, and the other I called union, so I pastored the flock. So Zechariah uses a couple descriptive items, a couple of metaphors to summarize his results in trying to pastor Israel. He had got two staffs, two sticks. He labels one of them favor, and the other one he labels union. So he's hoping that his divine pastoring of the nation will result in them receiving God's favor and perhaps a reuniting of the northern 10 tribes from the southern 2 tribes, and they would be a united nation again. So one staff will mark what happens to their standing before God. The other staff marks whether or not there is any union amongst the Jewish people there again. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month. Don't know, by the way, some of these prophecies are difficult to understand. This one is one of them. I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about here. It may be that the shepherds is the prophet, priest, and king, all of whom was supposed to be shepherding Israel and did not. And he eliminated all three of them. That may be what he's talking about here. For my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was weary of me. It doesn't sound like that went over real well, does it? Then I said, well, I will not pastor you. You guys are just too hard. To heck with you. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. He said, I'm going to give up on you. The nation is not going to respond to divine shepherding, so to heck with you. That reference to eating one another's flesh, I think may be a reference to the Roman siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, because that's what happened at that time. They ate each other. They had to become cannibals, eating their own children, the scriptures point out, because the Roman siege on Jerusalem was that severe. Remember, that siege was basically the end of Israel as a recognizable nation. In AD 70, the Romans came in there and leveled the place. Apparently took all of the stones from the temple, which the Lord said, there won't be one of these stacked on top of the other that you can find. Apparently they loaded him on ships and took him out in the Mediterranean and threw him in the ocean. Apparently. No excavating teams have ever found a stone from the temple in all of their excavating work in Jerusalem. Not one stone. And they were marked so you could tell which one belonged to that. The temple stones were all marked. So the Lord said that. He told the disciples, Matthew 24, that they pointed out the temple to him as they walked by, and the Lord said, yeah, I see it all right. But you ain't going to see it for long because it's going to disappear off the face of the earth, and it did. And so this reference to in Zechariah 11:10 may be a reference to that siege. So it was broken on that day. Well, so I took my staff, favor, the one that he hoped he could use as a symbol of God, their standing favorably before God, and he cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. So that aspect of his shepherding didn't work out. No favor. He cut his piece up into pieces. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. So there was some believing remnant there, and they saw and recognized that what was happening there was part of God's prophecy here. Then I said to him, well, if it's good in your sight, give me my wages, and if not, never mind. So, hey, how about paying me for my effort in trying to shepherd you? So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Now, that's what you call not prioritizing and valuing God's servants very much, because the 30 pieces of silver was the price of a slave. Is that ringing any bells to you, 30 pieces of silver? Well, that's what Judas got paid to betray the Lord. So I think this is an allusion to that ultimate event. So the shepherd of Israel got paid, well, his betrayer got paid 30 shekels of silver later on. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. Yeah, right. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. So what did Judas do with his 30 shekels of silver? Threw them into the temple. They in turn used it to pay for a little round where the guy could be buried or whatever. So all of this rejecting of their Messiah was kind of prophesied ahead of time here in Zechariah. So I took my second shaft, the one he labeled Union, he cut it in pieces too, to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Southern 2 tribes were called Judah, the northern 10 tribes were called Israel. There was no reuniting, no reunion of them. So he takes his second symbol and cuts it up into pieces as well. So one might call that a humongous failure. What wouldn't one? They didn't respond to him. There was no favor on God's part toward them, as symbolized by him cutting that shaft. There was no union between the northern and southern tribes, as symbolized by him cutting up that shaft. So the shepherding of Israel was a major, major failure. And when Messiah came, they not only rejected him, they killed him. So then the Lord said to me in verse 15, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. Okay, this time, Zechariah wants you to act out the role of a bad shepherd over the nation. For behold, I'm going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hooves. I think that's probably a reference to the coming Antichrist, and this is what he will do to them. You remember how the tribulation period gets started? Tribulation period is a 7-year period of time that precedes the millennium, the second advent and the millennium. That 7-year period of time gets started by a treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. Not between Israel and the U.S. Big Brother is not a player in this treaty. It is a treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. They need a treaty so badly that they will sign a treaty with Europeans who have a history of killing them in great numbers. What was it, six million in Poland alone? Am I remembering that correctly? Something like that. But they will sign a treaty with that guy because he says that he will protect them. He will be their shepherd. And they will need a treaty because they will be in a military conflict, I think with Iran, but that's debatable. They will be in a military conflict, and they will be getting beat up pretty good. They need a treaty, and the U.S. is not an option. And before this most recent election, that was real, real, real easy to see and understand. So they'll sign this treaty with the Antichrist, the head of the 10-nation federation there in Europe, and he, in turn, will turn on them to try to destroy them. Woe to the worthless shepherd, verse 17, who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally withered and his right eye will be blind. He will ultimately be destroyed. He's destroyed by the second coming of the Savior in Revelation 19. So Israel's resurgence, they're coming back together and being reunited to get prepared to observe the Messianic Kingdom, has been delayed for 2,600 years from the time this message was given to them in 500 B.C., and here we are at 2,000 something downstream from that. I'm rounding off here. So, what if they had received Messiah when he came? Well, the last 2,000 years of that 2,600 years would not have necessarily had to run its course. They could have accepted him. He could have instituted the Messianic Kingdom at the first advent. Could have. But they threw him out. They professed allegiance to the Romans, who they hated, instead of professing allegiance to God's Son, who came at the time prophecy said he would come, who came in the manner that prophecy said he would come. All of that stuff proved him to be the Messiah. They could have traced his ancestry. They could have checked out his history. They could have read the same book we're reading, but they didn't. They just killed him. So Zechariah foretold them of this delay, and they're experiencing it today. But it will happen. So he gets back to the positive approach to this here in chapter 12. The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus declares the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. You know, somehow or another, at the time of birth, we know how we get a new body. The physical aspects of that we understand reasonably well. There's some uniting together of chromosomes and cells start to divide, and next thing you know, you got this 6'6", 240-pound guy who has come on the scene. But how does he get his spirit? How is the spirit transferred at the time of birth? It must have something to do with the Father. Why do I say that? Because the Lord didn't have an earthly father, and he couldn't have a sinful spirit, a sin nature. He had to dance around that fact at his birth. The Holy Spirit made him a body. Hebrews chapter 11, 8, somewhere in through there, I forget. But the Holy Spirit made him a body. But how did he get a spirit? How do you get yours? They're not chromosomes making a spirit. Well, it looks like, from this passage, and it's a quote of Psalm 159, it looks like God, somehow or another, creates it, makes it, establishes, inputs it at the time of birth. I don't know exactly how he does that, but it looks like that's what he does here. Let me read you a little Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is a summary of some of the main basic characteristics of a sovereign creator. And he tells us some things. Let me read you Psalm 139 just as a reminder here. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou dost understand my thought from afar. That's pretty cool. God's a mind reader. He knows what you're thinking. Thou dost scrutinize my path and my lying down, and art intimately acquainted with all my ways. It's real hard to tap dance around God. You can't do it. Even for there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, thou dost know it all. Thou hast enclosed me behind and before, and thou and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I cannot attain to it. So God's all-knowing, his omniscience, is summarized in Psalm 139, first six verses. Then verses 7 through 12, his omnipresence is summarized. Verse 7, Psalm 139, where can I go from thy spirit? How can I flee from thy presence? Don't try to hide from God. That don't work. He knows where you are. If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If you somehow or another could run from him to heaven, he'd know you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. If you could run down and hide in hell from him, he knows you're there too. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there thy hand will lead me, and thy right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, I can hide from him in the dark, right? And the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is not dark to thee. God sees in the dark real well. He's like an owl. Dark doesn't bother him. The night is as bright as the day, and darkness and light are alike to thee. You cannot hide from God because he's omnipresent. You can't. He knows everything about you because he's omniscient. And here's what I was really trying to get to. Verse 13 through 18 talks about his omnipotence. For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. You think what's going on in a mother's womb is unimportant, irrelevant science of some kind? That's God's handiwork. You're messing with God's handiwork when you mess with the contents of the womb. I give thanks to thee, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was made in secret. God knows how big you are, what kind of a body you're going to occupy, what your frame looks like, and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. That's the womb. The depths of the earth is the mother's womb here. Thine eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. You know that you don't know, but you have an exact predetermined number of days to live. You just don't know how many there are, but God does. For some, it's relatively short. For others, it's relatively long. But he has determined how long you will live. The days that were ordained for me, yet before there was any of them, before you were ever born, it was determined how long you would live. Our buddy Joe got to 97. That's hooking him pretty good, isn't it? For a man. Ain't bad for a woman. So Joe's days were ordained to be 97 years and a few more days or whatever. How precious also are thy thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. You know, when you see this kind of detailed environment with God and the womb, what's that tell you a little bit about special needs children? Just flush them down the toilet? Is that what we do with special needs children? You run a test, and it turns out that you know the child's going to have Down syndrome. So let's just throw that child away. Let's terminate that child's life and get rid of him because it ain't normal. God is at work there, folks, with special needs children and everybody else. Nobody comes out of that womb without some divine oversight and involvement. So we don't treat the product of the womb as some kind of trash to just package up and throw away because it ain't normal. It's God's handiwork. So who gives us the right as men to abort infants? If that's God's handiwork, who are we that we make a judgment about God's handiwork and we say it ain't worth keeping? We're going to throw it out. We're going to destroy it. We tried years ago. I tried to get the, well, it didn't try, I got him. His name was Price. He was head of a organization here in Dallas that had to do with abortions and so on. And we're going to show a movie to the Sunday school class of an abortion. And we warned the ladies ahead of time. If they didn't want to come, they didn't have to, of course. And so many people, they didn't want to see that. I didn't want to see it either. But I felt like the class ought to see it. We had about 50 people in that class back in the day. But they knew it was so awful, they didn't want to see it. And yet, we write a check to some guy to do just that to an unwanted infant. Get rid of this infant. I don't want it. And rather than giving it birth and perhaps somebody else adopting it or something other than destruction of God's handiwork taking place, that's what we choose to do. There's going to be a day of reckoning for that. All of these helpless little infants that have been aborted, their heavenly Father oversees that. He knows that's going on, and he's going to ask somebody someday, why did you do that? And it's going to be an absolute chaos to try to listen to the explanations given by these doctors about why they thought that was okay to do. I wouldn't mind attending that particular judgment. I wouldn't mind hearing these people explain what they did to God's possession, God's work, God's handiwork in the womb and decided it was just so little value, we'll just throw it out. No, it ain't, guys. It's God's handiwork. Special needs children are children also. There's a reason they are like they are. I don't understand all of it. Remember that blind guy that the Lord encountered there in John chapter 9 with the disciples? He was blind, and they said, well, who sinned, this guy or his parents, that he was born blind? And the Lord said, neither one of them. That ain't the explanation, folks. They thought it was. There's other reasons for these things, and maybe we don't understand all of them. But let's understand this. The product in the womb is God's handiwork. Leave it the heck alone. If he wants it to perish before it can come into this world, he'll take care of that. If he wants it to come into this world with special needs, he'll take care of that. But it is not our right, our business, to mess with his handiwork. And the rest of Psalm 139 just has to do with God's holiness there. But the point of that passage is that somehow or another, God shepherds his people. He looks over them. He watches over them. He forms the spirit of man within him. I don't know how he does that, but somehow or another, that's how we get our spirit. God, he implants that sucker. And it has a sin nature because it is from man. The Father apparently transfers the sin nature somehow, because the Lord couldn't have a father, earthly father. So he had to have to step around that deal. But all the rest of us, we inherit somehow or another a spirit, an immaterial part of our being from God. Somehow. I don't know how. I know a little bit about how we get our physical bodies, but I don't know anything how we get our spirit. Too complicated for me. So verse 2, chapter 12. Behold, I'm going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. There's a day that is going to come, and it gets referred to here in a bunch of verses as in that day. It's the tribulation period is what that's a reference to. Israel is going to be a hard nut to crack and a problem for everybody. The armies of this world will go up and seize Jerusalem, and they will fight back. And it will come about in that day, that's during the tribulation period, that's between when this treaty is first signed by Israel and the Antichrist and the second advent of our Lord 7 years later, Revelation 19, it shall come about in that day, I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured. Why do all the nations want to attack Jerusalem? All the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. What do they have that all of these other nations want? What resource is it, I wonder? Now, if you're talking about Arab countries attacking Jerusalem, you don't need a natural resource. They just hate them so much. They'll attack them to kill them. All the Arab world will be more than happy to attack Israel to try to destroy them because they hate them so much. But what about everybody else? Why would other nations attack Israel, who is very capable of defending themselves, and try to take over that nation during the tribulation period? What have they got? Sand? They need a bunch of sand? Make some glass somewhere? Probably that ain't it. I wonder if they're going to discover oil in that place. What resource does Israel have or might have that all these other nations want? I don't know. But it won't surprise me, of course we'll be gone probably before we would even know this, if they discovered some kind of huge oil reserve. I don't know. Some natural resource to make batteries. Maybe they discover a bunch of lithium or something that everybody wants so they can keep their cell phones turned on. Somehow or another, they are going to be an object of attack from everybody because everybody wants whatever it is they have. All the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. In that day, that expression, by the way, is a reference to the tribulation period. In that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and his rider with madness, and I will watch over the house of Judah while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. The Lord is going to intervene on Israel's behalf against these armies that are attacking her and going to make their horses go bananas and the people go bananas. He's going to bring something to bear against them with blindness, some kind of a literal blindness, I guess. And the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, a strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem through the Lord hosts their God. Israel will recognize that God is fighting on their behalf. Their military success in this time will be a sign to them that God is actually helping them and fighting for them. In that day, I'll make the clans of Judah like a fire pot among pieces of wood and a flaming torch among sheaves, so that they will consume on the right hand and on the left and the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell in their own sites in Jerusalem. Israel's going to be very effective in defending themselves. They're going to put the hurt on a bunch of these countries that are in there trying to, for whatever reason, take over the place. And the Lord will save the tents of Judah first in order that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not be magnified above Judah. Judah will be successful. The southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, will be quite successful in that day. In that day, verse 8, the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David. David was about the best military leader you could find on earth during his life. That's the one guy you don't mess with during his time. And the feeble will be like him. They will be great warriors. And the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. They will kick some major booty during this time frame, Israel will. And it will come about in that day that I was set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So all of these people gathering together to try to destroy Jerusalem during the tribulation period, for whatever reason, they're not going to realize they're fighting God. It's God's people that they're trying to destroy, and God ain't going to let that happen. And he is going to pound the daylights out of them. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication so that they will look on me whom they have pierced. They will recognize during this preparation time, the tribulation period, preparation for the second advent, they will recognize that, oh my gosh, we killed God's son. We really blew it. They'll look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. In that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of some guy in the plain of Megiddo. This was a killing off of one of their good kings and that they mourned for. So the nation will recognize their mistake. And the ultimate restoration of them under the leadership of their Messiah will come together during the tribulation period. They will be preparing for him. And the land will mourn every family for itself, the family of the house of David by itself and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Nathan by itself and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Levi and their wives, the family of the Shimeites. These are kind of the high-end and low-end members of Jewish society. Everybody, from top to bottom, will mourn over the coming of Messiah and the realization that they destroyed him before. All the families that remain, every family by itself, and their wives by themselves. So, the ultimate restoration of Israel will take place. But it won't take place soon is Zechariah's message. It could have, but it didn't because Israel rejected the basis for that reconciliation, the Son of God, the Messiah. But it will come about. It is inevitable. God will fight for them. Israel will be fighting for their lives against all different kinds of nations here on earth. Whatever they're trying to get to, I'm not sure, but something of value. And God will pound them on Israel's behalf. We'll knock off here this morning. Any questions or comments now about this little bit of Zechariah's message we've seen here this morning? His message is a message that, Israel, you have a future. God is going to make sure you have a future. I'm going to judge you because you rejected my Son as your Messiah at the first advent. But at the second advent, I'm going to prepare you to actually receive Him and believe Him this time. And you will receive Him and believe Him at this time. And that consuming battle of mankind, the battle of Armageddon, as it's typically called, that's probably a series of battles. It's probably not just one battle, but that's essentially what's going on here. Israel fighting for its life, everybody trying to invade them for whatever reason, God fighting on their behalf, and ultimately they will be victorious. So Zechariah's message to the folks is, you got a future. You got a great future. But it's going to take a little longer than you think because you're going to reject that future in the near term, and God will bring it about in the long term. Any questions or comments about anything we saw here this morning? Remember, all of this is trying to be an encouragement to the exiles, to the people that should be building God's temple. This is to kind of get them motivated and focused and encouraged by the fact that they know they have a future. And that's the only nation on earth can say that. They know for certain they have a future. Not us. Imagine the Romans thought they had a future too, didn't they? And they did for a while. 400 or 500 years, and then they're gone. We've been around about 400 or 500 years, and looks like until recently, we were trying our best to be gone. But at any rate, Israel won't be. Israel remains. And the Savior will come, set up His 1,000-year reign here on earth, and Israel will realize that they'll be the most blessed people on the planet. Everybody who's trying to kill them off here during the tribulation period will be essentially their subjects. They will reign supreme over the rest of mankind. But he's not through. Zechariah's not quite through. We got a couple more chapters that will talk about the cleansing and preparation of Israel for the Messiah and how that will come about. So we got a little bit more Zechariah, and then we'll go back into Ezra where we left off, get a chapter or two, and then we'll do Esther because Esther occurs between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. And then after that we'll get Nehemiah and Malachi last. That's where we're headed. Any questions or comments? Some of these prophecies are a little bit subtle and difficult to know exactly what's going to happen. The detail of them is kind of, which after times kind of get general to summarize it. Well, it's going to be a time of restoration, but we're not exactly sure how it all works in every instance, but that's kind of what it's about anyway. Questions or comments about anything? Okay, you guys are going to be gone, right? Mm-hmm. Merry Christmas. Okay. You guys have a merry one. We'll continue on next week, but then we'll be gone the week after that. So the 29th, we won't be here.
Well, it's going to be cool. It's cold here at night. Anything below 60.
Well, don't run over any little old women getting to the cowboy game.
Oh, yeah, right.
It'll still be there when you get there.
Well, I'm not going to hold my breath.
No. You're not going to hold your breath for a lead when you get there, huh?
What about?
I might watch the Kansas City game instead. Yeah,
I think
people aren't going to invite
still there.
Good morning. Don King.
Nice to meet you. Samuel.
Samuel, pleased to meet you. What's your last name, Samuel?
Frondorf.
Say that again.
Frondorf.
Frondorf. I'll just call you Sam, okay?
It works with me.
All right, good.
He's from Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
You'd think I could say an Ohioan's name, but maybe, by way of Germany, might make it a little more harder. Anyway, glad to have you all with us this morning.
Thank you.
Join us anytime you want to.
Used to be there, and now there.
You guys have a good week. We'll see you next time. Okay.